Each year, tens of thousands of prisoners in New York become eligible for parole. They go before a board, make their case, and after a short hearing, their fate gets decided. The idea is that if someone has served their minimum sentence and is no longer dangerous, they should get a second chance at freedom. But the practice is far more complicated. Parole board officers are overworked and undertrained with virtually no oversight. In many states, they release only a tiny fraction of eligible prisoners. This has a lot of people calling for parole reform. With us today to discuss why the system needs to be changed are journalists Katie Rose Quant and Victoria Law. Katie Rose's recent article in the Outline, The False Hope of Parole, investigates the parole board in Missouri. Victoria has covered parole for years for The Village Voice and Injustice Today. Welcome to Midday to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Katie Rose, let's start with the basics. What is the legal definition of parole?
Yeah, so parole is conditional release from prison, as you said, after you finish your minimum sentence. So you often hear of someone having a sentence of maybe like 10 to 15 years or 25 years to life. And so after you finish the front end of that, the minimum, you'll be eligible to go before the parole board. And if they deem you safe and ready for society, you can go finish the maximum, the back end of your sentence, out on parole, like under parole supervision in the community. So it's supposed to allow people to kind of transition from prison to the streets by having this intermediate period where they're under supervision but no longer in prison.
And how often do you get a parole? So if you get rejected the first time, do you go every year?
It totally depends on the state. In the story that I wrote, the person in Missouri wasn't going to be eligible again for another 4 years. I think 2 years is often the case. It depends on the state.
I see. So the Supreme Court considers parole a, quote, act of grace. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that goes back to precedent going back to like 1973. Mm-hmm. And someone who was in federal prison went before the parole board. There actually isn't parole in federal prison anymore, but back then there was. And he was denied, and so he sued saying that they weren't following their own guidelines. He was ready, and he was denied. And the courts decided that parole is not a right, it's a privilege. So it's really hard to get the parole decisions to be reviewed. And depending on the state, Missouri really sticks to that. And in the past, when people have sued the parole board, the courts have just kind of blocked them and said, like, you don't have a right to this. We can't review their decisions.
So, Victoria, who serves on parole boards? How do they get chosen? What kind of oversight is there?
In most states, parole commissioners are appointed by the governor. In New York State, legislators can put forward the names of the people they want appointed to the governor, but it is ultimately up to the governor to appoint parole commissioners. In New York State, a parole commissioner needs to only have a college degree and 5 years of experience in either criminal justice, sociology, law, social work, or medicine. Most people come out of the criminal justice system, so they've worked in law enforcement or they've worked in corrections, either on parole or as prison administrators. And the annual salary is $101,000 a year for a parole commissioner. So this is not a volunteer job. This is a highly sought after position. And oftentimes it's a political appointment from the governor to one of his fellow legislators.
So Katie Rose, in your article, you describe just how parole boards juggle too many cases. So, for instance, you say that New York conducted more than 10,700 interviews in 10 months in 2014. Mm-hmm. So, assuming they only work 5 days a week, if you do the math, that's like over 50 interviews a day.
And actually, they don't conduct interviews every day. Interviews are typically conducted only 2 days each week. So,
that's even more.
Yes.
That's a lot more. So either whoever wants to answer this question, what does an interview look like then?
In New York State, the interview used to be done in person. Now it's done by video. So the there are typically two or three parole commissioners sitting in a room with a video monitor, and people in various prisons are shuffled to the video monitor on the other side. And until last year, they typically lasted about 10 minutes. One parole commissioner would actually be running the interview while the other two would be flipping through to the next file to prepare for the next interview that was happening. Oftentimes, parole commissioners would focus largely on the nature of the crime, which is the one aspect of a person's life they can never change, and there would be a lot less focus on any rehabilitative efforts since then, how long the person had been in prison, what their disciplinary record or their prison record was like since then, how old they were, if they were a threat to society. So this is typically what had happened over the course of the last however many years until last year, when efforts at parole reform finally succeeded in having the governor not reappoint several of the most punitive parole commissioners and appointing several new commissioners who had less of a law enforcement corrections background and a more progressive look at parole. I also want to add that in other states, some people don't even appear before the parole board. The parole hearing is conducted solely with all of the paperwork that has been amassed, and they don't get to make their case that they've rehabilitated themselves.
Wow, that's amazing. And in Missouri, you do get to go in front.
You do. As in New York, it's over video most of the time.
But you don't get to see your file.
No,
and,
yeah.
And you describe how one prisoner that was seeking parole talks about how a parole board member started alluding to something he had done that was in his file, but he didn't really know what he was talking about.
Yeah, in Missouri, you even like as a public member of the public or even the person whose hearing it is, you have no right to access what's in the file. You have no right to access a copy of the transcript. So if you wanted to look back over and see what had gone wrong, you just can't see anything.
Right. And also in Missouri, you describe how prosecutors can show up to these hearings.
Mm-hmm, yeah. In the person whose story I wrote, the district attorney came and actually started describing the case differently than it had been prosecuted originally. And there was also a victim who came and spoke. And he himself only had a couple minutes of questions. His hearing lasted somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes. But the vast majority of it was not him getting a chance to make a case for his freedom and his rehabilitation.
Wow. And Victoria, to be denied parole repeatedly can be pretty devastating
yes.
to people. So you wrote about 70-year-old John McKenzie, who committed suicide after his 10th parole denial. One of the board members who denied him was named W. William Smith.
Yes.
A judge had actually barred Smith from participating in that hearing. Can you explain why?
So John McKenzie, when he was a younger man in 1974, I believe, was involved in a burglary in which he then shot and killed a police officer. And in many states, New York is not exceptional in this, parole commissioners are very reluctant to grant parole to people who are convicted of killing a police officer. There's a huge amount of opposition anytime somebody with that kind of conviction goes before the parole board. And they are, even though people with murder convictions are the least likely to recidivate or to commit a new crime, mm-hmm. They're often the ones most often denied parole. So he had gone before the parole board 10 times, and each time he had been denied parole. It didn't matter that he had a nearly spotless prison record. It didn't matter that he was 70 years old. It didn't matter that he had turned his life around. What was focused on primarily was the nature of his crime, the fact that he had committed this crime in 1975. And at this 10th parole hearing, after his 9th parole denial, he actually filed what's known as an Article 78, which in New York State is a way that you can challenge an administrative decision, such as a parole denial. And a judge granted him a new parole hearing. It doesn't mean you get parole. It means you simply get to go before the parole board again. And that was when the judge said that W. William Smith could not be part of that hearing. Why that was ignored, I'm not sure. Why no action was taken when it was found out, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But the outcome was that John McKenzie was denied parole again, and he was returned to he went back to his cell block, and then several days later hung himself.
Wow. And so that sparked an outcry.
Yes. And he became a symbol of what was wrong with the parole system. Like, no matter what you do, no matter how many certificates of completing programs that you have, no matter what kind of rehabilitative efforts you make, he had actually started a sort of restorative justice program in one of the prisons he had been in so that people could understand the impact of their crimes, where people who had been impacted by crimes came and talked to other men and said, you know, this is what happened after you did what you did to me. This is what the effects of an assault or a robbery or something else have on me, even weeks, months, or years later.
So I'm sorry, he started a program.
Yes, he actually started a program in one of the prisons he was in to so that other people could understand that the assault or the action that somebody takes isn't just in that moment, but it can have repercussions for the victim for months, if not years to come, and people could understand and take fuller responsibility for what they had done. And none of that mattered to the parole board. What mattered is that in 1975, John McKenzie took this action, and it's not something that he can ever change, and that was going to be the thing that was held against him.
And so what sort of reforms are advocates looking for, and what's been changed so far?
Advocates have been asked, so backing up again, so in 2011, the parole board was supposed to begin considering risk assessment. So not just the nature of the crime, but what the person had done since they had been incarcerated. How much of a risk or not risk to society did they pose? You know, how old were they? What was their likelihood of committing a new crime? What had they been doing since they'd been in prison? What kind of efforts had they been making to improve themselves? And all of these are supposed to be taken into consideration, not just the nature of the crime, but again and again and again, what happens in these parole hearings is that parole commissioners were focused on the nature of the crime, thus ignoring all of these other mandates and requirements to basically follow this new policy. So parole advocates have been saying, well, first, parole board commissioners have to follow their own rules and guidelines. And then they've been calling for the most punitive parole commissioners to be removed from the parole board so that there is some, you know, some fairness in this, and it's not just people who believe in the harshest punishment possible.
Has that happened?
So that has happened. Last summer, I believe it was three parole commissioners were not reappointed, people with very punitive track records for denying people parole, particularly those accused of violent crime or those convicted of violent crimes. And several new parole commissioners were appointed who had more diverse backgrounds. So it wasn't necessarily just law enforcement, just people who had worked in prisons, just people who had worked for parole.
I see. So, Katie, in Missouri, you met a prisoner named Norman Brown. Can you tell us a little bit about Norman?
Yeah, so Norman Brown, when he was 15 years old, he was an accomplice in an armed robbery. And his older accomplice shot the man and woman who were working behind the counter in this store. Norman was actually outside at the time. But they were both convicted of first-degree murder. He was charged as an adult, and that came with a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. So this 15-year-old went away, and he had no hope of ever coming out. And so the thing that kind of changed for him was there were these Supreme Court decisions in 2012 and 2016 that made it unconstitutional to sentence juveniles to life with, to life without parole. And so that meant that Missouri had to like reckon with the fact that they had about 100 people serving this now unconstitutional sentence, including Norman Brown. And so that what they decided to do was make them parole eligible after 25 years.
And it's like 2,100 people nationally, is that right?
Yeah.
Fall into this category?
Yeah, there's about 2,100 people who were sentenced to life without parole when they were under the age of 18.
And can you explain what the Supreme Court decision was about? Was it based on brain science?
It was, yes. So basically, science shows that people under the age of 18, their brains are not fully developed. They are more reckless. They're more susceptible to peer pressure. They don't think out their decisions as well. And so the court has just decided that it's not fair to treat those children as if they had adult brains and were thinking as rationally as an adult.
And so in Missouri, you call them JLWOPs, J-L-W-O-P-S.
J-L-W-O-P, yeah.
So that's Juvenile Serving Life Without Parole is what it stands for. So, you know, the state had to consider whether to, the state had to give them a chance.
Exactly.
But what we see when you quote the overall numbers of release, and so you say that 81% of the people who seek parole are released in Missouri. That's overall, that's the whole population. Mm-hmm. But when you just look at these JLWOPs, only 9% are granted parole.
Yeah.
That surprises me because I would think that a parole board member would be more sympathetic towards someone who committed a crime when they were 15 or you know, juvenile.
So one big factor in those differences is that overall number includes people who were not convicted of violent offenses. and that 81% approval rate. And like as Victoria was saying, parole board members are much more likely to grant release to someone who had like a property crime or a drug crime. But it doesn't seem like they are having any more sympathy for this particular class of people who committed crimes when they were their teenagers.
And I guess if you were, if your sentence was life without parole as a juvenile, you did something pretty serious.
You would
except,
think so.
Right, except for this man, Norman Brown.
Yeah, that's not that uncommon. There were a lot of states that had mandatory life without paroles for any sorts of, in his case, it was first-degree murder, but there's a way that you can be charged with first-degree murder even if you weren't the one who pulled the trigger, if you were helping someone commit a felony, which is what happened with him, so.
Right, right. So with Brown, what did the Supreme Court say were the factors the parole board was supposed to consider?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court said that people can't be sentenced to life without parole under the age of 18 unless they are, the language is like the rare juvenile who is irredeemable or something like that. It should be a very, very unusual thing.
And then there also has to be a special hearing before the judge can do that. So he can't just say, I decide that you're irredeemable, I'm sentencing you. There needs to be an additional hearing about that.
And so Missouri trying to retroactively deal with the fact that they had people serving the sentence, like Norman Brown, who certainly never had that special hearing, they decided, the Missouri legislature passed a law saying that all these guys, there's about 100 of them serving a sentence, they need to have those factors considered in their parole hearing. So the parole board is supposed to consider their undeveloped brain at the time of the incident, their family life, their possibility of living a successful life in the future.
I see. I'm speaking with Katie Rose Quant and Victoria Law. Quant's story in the outline is The False Hope of Parole, and Law's story for Injustice Today is Can Police Opposition Overturn Parole Reform? This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC, and I'm back with Katie Rose Quant and Victoria Law. So, ladies, a lot of this is about risk. Parole board members don't want to get scrutinized and blamed if they release someone and then that person goes out and commits some horrible crime. What do we know about reoffense rates? What percentage of people, for instance, commit another felony after they get released?
Well, the there are two ways in which somebody can be sent back to prison for a parole violation. The majority of people who are sent back to prison for parole violations are sent back to prison coming off of parole are for parole violations. And these are not necessarily they've committed a new crime or committed new harm, but for technical violations like missing your appointment with your parole officer, which anybody who has ever taken a bus or a subway in New York City can know that it is very easy to be late or to miss an appointment, for failing a drug test, you know, so you smoke a little bit of weed or you're around people who smoke weed and you fail a drug test, or in New York and in many other places, people on parole cannot associate with other people who have felony convictions, which then means that if you are living in a place where there are a lot of people with felony convictions, or if you are trying to reconnect with a friend who also has a felony conviction, that is a parole violation and it can send you back to prison. In New York City jails alone, about 15% of the people in jails are locked up for these technical parole violations. So that's about 1,500 people.
Is not having a job a technical parole violation?
It can be, depending on your parole officer. And having a felony conviction makes it extremely difficult to find a job. So you can kind of see this quagmire, this catch-22.
Right. I don't know if either of you ran into this, but I know in some of my reporting and in talking to people who've served time, they've said to me that they don't take parole. They just serve their time because they know that they're not going to be able to meet the requirements of parole. I don't know if either of you have ever run into that. I mean, these are people that are not serving super long sentences. Mm-hmm. They're shorter sentences, but
I have not heard that, but that's a stunning indictment of the parole system and the way that people who live inside prisons, which are hugely restrictive and oppressive, view this opportunity to get out earlier. And also, I just also want to add that in New York State, for every 10 people who successfully complete parole and don't go back to prison, 9 people are reincarcerated for parole violations, mostly these dumb technical violations.
I see.
Again, so we can see how this parole system, even if you get parole, is designed to shuffle people back into the system.
So, Katie Rose, you also looked at statistics that were not about technical violations. Weren't you looking at statistics that were about actually committing another serious crime?
Yeah, so it's almost a little paradoxical, but the people who commit the most serious crimes, such as homicide, are actually the least likely to reoffend. And it's hard to find good statistics on this, largely because this population is often not released. Mm-hmm. But there's been a few instances where California did some analysis of the people who were released on parole who had been convicted of a homicide over the course of several years. And in all of that time, I think like a very, very small percentage of them committed another felony, and none of them committed another homicide. So it's usually something people mature out of, they grow up, it's not something people usually reoffend.
How many years after they were released was the study looking at?
In that particular study, I believe it was like 5 years later. It was people released over a period of time, and then they looked at them 5 years from the end of that range,
I think. Okay. So you also write that repeated parole denials feed mass incarceration, and that the reluctance to accept that people have changed fits with this particularly punitive American outlook that defines people by the worst thing that they ever did. So how does this change? What sort of conversations, this is a question for either of you, what sort of conversations do we need to have to redefine or understand what justice looks like?
Well, I think that one thing that people don't really realize is, well, most people know that we have too many people in U.S. prisons, but obviously that's largely driven by drug sentencing, but it's also driven by violent crime sentencing. And we've just kind of come to this general consensus that a life sentence is a very reasonable thing to give out, or, you know, denial after denial after denial for parole is just a reasonable expectation. And I think that that's one conversation that we really need to be having, is looking at the numbers and looking at these individuals who have changed and have served many years in prison, and asking whether they really are a risk to society and whether we need to be keeping all of these people locked up for so long.
I think another thing that we need to be thinking about is this idea that we should identify and punish people by the worst action that they've ever committed, or the worst action that they've ever been caught committing. So we see this with parole, we see this with sentencing, with these harsh sentences, we see this with life without parole, either for juveniles or for adults, or these overly harsh sentences where people get sentenced to 60 years in prison, 75 years in prison, so they're not even eligible for parole until they're, what, 98, 100, something like that, and then we see this with parole hearings, especially when somebody has committed a violent offense, where again and again and again, that's the one thing that you cannot change. It doesn't matter if you're 70 years old. It doesn't matter if you've, you know, completed 10 different programs and you've started some other programs and you've done all of these other things, to make sure that you are never, ever, ever in a position where you would commit that kind of harm again. It's defining somebody by the worst mistake that they've ever made. And then in some states, so New York State, with the exception of 70-year-old Herman Bell and a few other people, once you are granted parole, very little can be done to rescind that parole. In other states, like in California and in Oklahoma, if you are granted parole and you have a violent conviction, the governor of that state has to approve your parole. And in California, until recently, until Governor Brown took office, a lot of people, especially older people who had convictions for violent crimes, were granted parole because they were elderly, they'd shown remorse, they'd taken responsibility, they were no longer that person they were when they were 20 or 30.
Right.
And the governor would veto their parole. So then you would send grandma or grandpa back to prison to wait another couple of years to go before the parole board. The parole board would say, yes, you're no longer a threat to society, we grant you parole, but because you have a violent crime, the governor has to sign off on this. And if the governor doesn't, then back you go on the merry-go-round of prison, parole hearing, being granted parole, and probably being denied.
Did either of you guys come across a particular state that seems to be doing it right? Or is there any, you know, what should be the release rate? Is there any sort of guidance or studies on any of this?
I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I would say the fact that release rates are so low People aren't even going up for parole until they have completed the minimum sentence that their original sentencing judge gave them. So I think that, you know, it shouldn't be so close to zero like it is in so many of these cases, especially for people who are convicted of violent offenses. Like, the front end of their sentence is something that the original judge thought would be a reasonable sentence for them, right, unless there was some reason to deny them parole.
Victoria, you mentioned Herman Bell. Do you want to talk, yes, a little bit about who Herman Bell is?
Yes. So Herman Bell is a 70-year-old man who is currently imprisoned. In 1971, he was a Black Panther, and he was involved in the shooting death of two police officers. He has been in prison for the past 45 years, and he has been eligible for parole since 2004. This past March was his eighth parole hearing. So each time he was denied parole, he was sent back to prison. He was, you know, kept in prison for another couple of years until he went before the parole board again. This past March, he had his eighth parole hearing. Two of the three commissioners at his hearing were the new appointees that Cuomo had appointed last summer. Mm-hmm. One was an older commissioner. And two of the three commissioners voted to grant him parole. It's a majority rules type of decision. It doesn't have to be a consensus. So one of the one old commissioner and one of the new commissioners opted to grant him parole. And there was an immediate backlash around this. But they had looked at his age, the fact that he had taken full responsibility for his crime, the fact that he talked about his remorse. He talked about how at the time, as a Black Panther, he thought that he was doing a political action, and now he realizes that it was not what he had thought it was. They looked at the fact that he had a near impeccable prison record, he had not been in any fights, he had family support, and very importantly, he had the support of the family of one of the victims. So there were two police officers who were killed. One of the victims' families said, "We think that to keep him in prison would just be a travesty. You know, we miss our loved one, but keeping him in prison is not the answer." Right. The other family, you know, the widow of the other police officer wants to keep him in prison forever. So Katie mentioned earlier about victims coming and giving their impact statements. And what's interesting is that victim impact statements often seem to be heard primarily if they're the voices that want to keep somebody punished forever and ever. And there doesn't seem to be given equal weight to the victims who say, "Actually, keeping this man in prison doesn't bring our loved one back. Hmm. It doesn't help us at all. It doesn't help us with the healing process. Just let him go on with his life and let us go on with our lives."
Now, one thing, just to go back to Herman Bell real quick, did he deny that he did this at first?
At first, he did. He did not. He did deny that he did this at first. He did say that it was a political crime and it was a politically motivated crime. And then recently he began taking responsibility for this.
I see. Isn't it? I mean, I know you're saying that it's the voices of wanting to keep someone in prison that are heard the loudest. Both sides, though, have equal access, right? They can both be heard. You're just saying that the parole board members listen more to people who want to keep people in prison.
Yes, parole board members, the media. I feel like there is a greater emphasis on people who say, "Please keep this person in prison," or "Please execute this person," or "Please punish this person as harshly as possible," rather than the voices that are saying, "We don't want this kind of punishment exacted in our name."
So is Herman Bell, has he been released?
So Herman Bell was granted parole in March. The Police Benevolent Association and others and other politicians immediately started calling for him not to be released, for the parole commissioners who had granted him parole to be fired. So they were basically like voicing their opposition. And the widow of one of the police officers actually filed in court to block his release. And his hearing is actually, the hearing for that case is actually tomorrow in Albany. So, and a judge has decided that Herman Bell cannot be released until after this court date. So he would have gone home April 17th had it not been for this court date. And now it's all pending.
I see. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yes. Victoria,
you write that the number of people returned to prison for parole violations increased 21% between 2015 and 2016. Is that right in your article?
Yes.
So what accounts for that?
I think, again, it's the stringent nature of parole and parole violations. It's not necessarily that they are, you know, that people are committing new crimes. Mm-hmm. It's the violations again. Yeah, and if we think about living in a place like New York City or any large city that is gentrifying, that is becoming more expensive, where you have more and more and more people, you know, in a crumbling infrastructure around public transportation and everything else, it becomes increasingly easy to, like, slip up and be late for an appointment, miss an appointment, you know, do all these other things, like not be able to fulfill these strict criteria.
Right. And what sort of planning also goes into a release? In other words, are people helped with housing? Are they helped with if they have mental health or physical health needs? Are they connected to any sorts of services that can help them, you know, become stable?
In New York State, and in many other states, no, not really. Parole officers are not social workers in the sense that they don't connect you with housing, employment opportunities, and also parole officers have a huge caseload. So even the best meaning parole officer may not necessarily be able to say, hey, let me help you find housing. In New York City, people with felony convictions are not allowed in public housing, which means that if you get out of prison and your family lives in public housing, if you stay on your grandmother's couch, your grandmother is subject to eviction for putting you up. So that means then that your options might be going to a homeless shelter or going to what's called a three-quarters house. It's like, you know, like where you pay a lot of money for a room there, which may not necessarily be safe for people who've struggled with substance abuse issues or other issues. It might mean that they're in danger of relapse or violating some of the conditions of their parole by staying there.
So, Katie Rose, let's talk about Norman Brown. He mm-hmm. has sued the state of Missouri.
Yes.
And he was moved to protective custody,
yeah.
which you describe as solitary confinement. Are you saying that that was retaliation?
That's what his sister, I talked to his sister, and she fears that that was retaliation, that he was moved to another prison right after the lawsuit was introduced. I haven't spoken with the people who decided to move him.
And what could be the result of the lawsuit? What is the lawsuit asking for?
So it's a class action lawsuit on behalf of, as I said, those about 100 people who are in his situation. They were formerly serving life without parole. Now they're eligible for parole, but they're not really getting it. And what they're hoping for is a court order that requires the Missouri Parole Board to actually follow those mitigating circumstances to consider their youth, their development, their life circumstances.
All right, and we'll leave it there. I've been speaking with Katie Rose Quant and Victoria Law. Quant's story in the outline is The False Hope of Parole, and Law's story for Injustice Today is Can Police Opposition Overturn Parole Reform? Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.